KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The Education Department's End DEI portal allows pretty much anyone to report on public school staff. What can and can't they say under the Trump administration? Our series on the state of the First Amendment continues on Morning Edition from NPR News. Global stock markets rally after President Trump pauses tariffs on most goods for 90 days. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Also, Trump orders the Justice Department to investigate some of his critics. He's targeting folks who once worked for him. Our co-host, A. Martinez, tries out strength training and talks with senior citizens about the benefits of exercise. It's Thursday, April 10th. An American literary classic, The Great Gatsby, turns 100 today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened lower this morning despite a better-than-expected report on inflation from the Labor Department. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 900 points in early trading.
Inflation cooled even more than expected last month, thanks in part to a big drop in gasoline prices. Overall, prices in March were up 2.4% from a year ago. Prices actually fell slightly between February and March, although grocery prices continue to climb. Investors would ordinarily welcome the positive inflation news, but there are lingering concerns that President Trump's trade war could push prices higher in the months to come. While Trump has now suspended many of his new tariffs for 90 days, he left in place a 10% tax on nearly everything the U.S. imports, along with a much higher tax that could more than double the price of goods coming in from China. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says he believes Republican leaders have now secured enough votes to pass a multi-trillion-dollar budget framework. The vote is scheduled to start this morning on the House floor. The measure contains much of President Trump's domestic agenda. There had been opposition from fiscal conservatives in the House who said it did not do enough to cut the deficit. Johnson says the measure addresses many concerns.
We are committed to funding at least $1.5 trillion in savings for the American people, while also preserving our essential programs. The Democrats are out right now trying to make hay out of the fact that we're going to gut Medicaid and all these other things. It's simply not true. We're going to protect the essential programs for everybody who's eligible to receive those. And you'll see that reflected in the final bill.
The House will still need to agree with the Senate on a final budget blueprint. President Trump says that Israel would lead in any military action against Iran to prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Trump's remarks come ahead of talks between Iran and the United States slated for this weekend. NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi reports from Tel Aviv.
Speaking to reporters on Wednesday, President Trump said he was ready to order military strikes against Iran to stop it from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
If it requires military, we're going to have military. Israel will obviously be very much involved in that. He'll be the leader of that.
After a White House meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump said there would be direct talks with Iran this weekend, but later Iran said they would in fact be indirect. Netanyahu, who has been outspoken in the past and calling for military pressure on Iran to prevent it from developing a nuclear weapon, said this week that he would support a diplomatic agreement that would see Iran give up its nuclear program. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks are lower on Wall Street. The Dow was down more than 900 points. That's more than 2%. The Nasdaq is down 600 points. That's 3.5%. It's NPR. Officials in the Dominican Republic have increased the death toll from this week's disaster at a music hall. At least 218 people were killed when the roof fell in at the music venue on Monday night. A popular singer, two former Major League Baseball players, and a politician are among the dead. Dominican officials say they have shifted to a recovery phase focused on finding bodies. New research suggests that given the right training, artificial intelligence therapy bots can deliver effective mental health care. The results of the first clinical trial with an AI therapy bot are published in the New England Journal of Medicine. NPR's Katia Riddle reports.
There are already a lot of AI therapists on the market, but many aren't effective and some are even dangerous. Researchers at Dartmouth College decided to train a bot over 5 years in therapeutic best practice. Nick Jacobson is a clinical psychologist who worked on this effort. He says with a therapy bot, no appointments are necessary.
You can access it anywhere, anytime, which is dramatically different from how regular care would be provided, which is, you know, once a week in a defined time and place.
Researchers say it will be some time before the tested therapy bot is widely available. Katia Riddle, NPR News.
Chinese scientists think that the far side of the moon may be a lot more dry than the side that faces the Earth. They studied lunar dirt from a Chinese probe that landed on the far side of the moon last year, the first human craft to do so. The scientists say this can help them understand how the moon evolved. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The European Union is delaying its planned retaliatory tariffs after President Trump announced a pause on most levies for 90 days. Markets rebounded Wednesday over Trump's pause, but they were down again in early trading. His 125% tariff on China is still in place, and Beijing has slapped an 84% tariff on all U.S. goods. The escalating trade war has weakened China's currency to its lowest level since 2007. You'll hear more about that later in the program. But first, we're going to turn to our exploration of free speech in the United States today.
For years, Sarah Einema had a poster hanging in her Idaho classroom, a poster that encouraged her sixth grade students to be kind, to be inclusive. Everyone is welcome here, it said in bright multicolored letters.
It has images of hands of different skin tones underneath it that have little hearts in the palm of their hands.
She got it at a classroom supply store, and it had never drawn any attention until recently.
I just was approached by my principal and vice principal. They told me that they were having to go through the school and have posters that have controversial messages taken down.
When she pressed them on what was controversial,
they told me teachers aren't allowed to have posters that show their personal or like political opinions on things. And this was now seen as a personal opinion.
Today, on the State of the First Amendment, the right from which all rights flow, rooting out diversity, equity, and inclusion in public schools. Sarah did not take the poster down for very long.
I just woke up and was like, I just can't stop thinking about it. It's just so wrong. I just felt so gross, feeling complacent in it, and I just came in on a Saturday with my husband and my baby and put it back up, and I emailed my principal to let him know that I had done that.
What did the principal say?
He did come to my classroom, and he said that is considered insubordination. After I put it back up, one of our district personnel, our chief academic officer, he told me that political environments ebb and flow, and what might not have been controversial 3 or 6 or 9 months ago can be considered controversial now.
In a statement, the school district confirmed Aynama's recounting of what happened, saying it wasn't the words, but the colors of the letters and the different skin tones of the hands that they, quote, determined to potentially express viewpoints regarding specific identity groups.
When I was told that it doesn't allow for people to express differing opinions, there's only two opinions of that poster. You either believe that everyone is welcome here or you don't. I just was so shocked, especially on the basis of skin tone.
Are they still up in your classroom?
Mm-hmm.
And you're still teaching at the school?
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's not the only teacher feeling watched over the hunt for diversity, equity, and inclusion. When we asked you, our readers and listeners, if you felt freer or more silenced in this moment, a teacher from Oregon wrote to us. She was so worried about speaking, she asked to only go by her first initial, E.
Just where I live and where I teach is a really small community, and I'm definitely worried about getting reported.
What she's referring to there is a new portal from the Department of Education called EndDEI, where you can report any instances of lessons around diversity, equity, and inclusion. When E first heard about it in the news, she thought it couldn't be real. Then she looked it up.
And I was like, oh my gosh, like it literally just says students, parents, teachers, you can report when you see instances. So I was like, oh my gosh.
E's mind started racing.
Immediately, I kept thinking about what did I say in class today? What was asked in class today? What could be taken out of context in class today? Who's mad at me right now for changing their seats or something like that? Could someone use this against me for something I've done in the recent past? So I was pretty scared.
Can you describe how that sort of changed your teaching behavior in the classroom?
I mean, the very next day, kids are asking me questions. There are so many times where I just have to tell them I can't answer that question, or I just change the subject, or I think about how I'm going to say it in a way that gives them the information they need, but also in a way that's going to cover my butt.
A year ago, did you feel the same way?
No, I did not. Right now, in our current environment, in our current political place, it's becoming easier and easier for certain people to have the right to free speech and for others to be having theirs shut down. And I think it's just been a big shift as to what's acceptable speech and what is now considered, you know, a DEI report issue.
If we were doing this interview about freedom of speech a year ago, would you have given me your full name?
Yes, I would have.
The Education Department has not responded to our repeated requests for comment on how this portal works or what penalty teachers reported would face. So we reached out to a group that endorsed the EndDEI portal, a right-wing advocacy group called Moms for Liberty. It was founded in the midst of the COVID pandemic by moms who felt unheard and shut out by school administrators and school board members over objections to masking policies and school closures. One of its co-founders is Tina Deskovich, a Florida mom who says the portal was created to serve a need.
Our parents across the country and people that aren't even members email us things that they find in their school districts, practices, policies that they find concerning. And there really was nowhere to report that.
If you could give me an example of the type of complaint that you think the DEI portal would then handle.
The things that I've seen that I know people have forwarded it on to the DEI portal are lessons where they divide children by race and call, you know, black children the victims or the oppressed, white children are the oppressors. So that would be something absolutely somebody should fill out in the DEI portal.
An executive order on, quote, radical indoctrination in K-12 schooling to end diversity, equity, and inclusion in public schools makes a similar claim. But we couldn't find examples in public schools of lessons where kids were physically divided by race, as Deskovich described. Moms for Liberty pointed to a Florida public arts high school that planned separate meetings for students of color and white students 4 years ago. It later canceled them and apologized. Now, getting rid of DEI is not the only issue driving Moms for Liberty. The group has pushed to ban books largely on racism, discrimination, sexuality, or LGBTQ rights. Members post anti-LGBTQ rhetoric, and at a chapter meeting 3 years ago, a member talked about gunning down a school librarian. All of this is why the Southern Poverty Law Center labeled the group extremist in 2023. Back at the height of the pandemic, it was a charged environment. Parents were shouting down school board members. There was a spike in violent threats against school staff and school board members, like this threat.
You know your home address is on the internet, don't you? That could be a little scary.
Which prompted the National School Board Association to ask the Biden administration to intervene. Moms for Liberty has framed the FBI's investigation of those violent threats against school board members as a politically motivated campaign to silence parents and organizations like theirs. Again, Deskovich.
Parents were just showing up, trying to voice their opinions, sometimes, you know, not really that nice to school board members. They were angry about things that were going on with their children, but in no way, shape, or form should they have had the DOJ, the federal government, coming after them.
You know, it's no secret that the Southern Poverty Law Center and other organizations see Moms for Liberty as an extremist organization, as a far-right organization that actually is in opposition to LGBTQ plus and racially inclusive school curriculums, that it advocates for book bans. What do you make of that, and how is that connected to what you were describing?
I and my co-founder both served in a public school board for 4 years, dedicated my life during that time to that. We believe in the public education system. We believe in America's founding principles and our government. We are not anti-government, but we absolutely have the right, guaranteed in the First Amendment, to address government officials when we think they are not on the right track.
In just a few years, a lot has changed for Moms for Liberty. With Trump's election, the doors to the White House are open to the group.
Well, thank you very much.
Members were at the signing of executive orders, one for banning transgender athletes from women and girls' sports, another for dismantling the Department of Education.
And it sounds strange, doesn't it? Department of Education, we're going to eliminate it, and everybody knows it's right.
Not only does the right-wing advocacy group feel freer to speak these days, they seem to have the ear of the president.
A lot of these executive orders speak to the struggle that our organization and many other organizations have experienced over the last 4 and 5 years. I hope that government will be much more open. I think people in the administration really want to see changes that will open up the government more, and that's good for all Americans, left, right, Republican, Democrat. I have a lot of hope.
You know, I think there were people who felt like what you were advocating for was dangerous for certain Americans. I'm just wondering in this moment if it's free speech for everyone or just free speech for some.
Well, the Constitution of the United States of America guarantees free speech for everyone. And if anyone in America is being silenced in the way that we were silenced the last several years, they need to do the things that we do. They need to organize. They need to petition their government. We have filed lawsuits, and we've been victorious because the legal system in America does work. It may take time, but it does work. You know, I am willing to stand with someone, anyone, for their right to speak.
But it is the policies her group has advocated for, like the NDEI portal, chilling the speech of some teachers in public schools. Morning Edition invited Education Secretary Linda McMahon or the Vice President J.D. Vance to sit down with us for a conversation about free speech. We have not heard back, and that invitation is still open. Tomorrow on the State of the First Amendment, the right from which all rights flow. Withholding funding, investigating alleged failures to stop anti-Semitism, detaining and deporting students.
If anything, this administration is trying to eliminate academic freedom.
We look at who feels free to speak and who does not on college campuses. This is NPR News.
of the next fresh air, journalist Gardner Harris talks about his book, Investigating Johnson & Johnson. Last month, the company lost a bid to settle lawsuits that claimed its talc powder products, including baby powder, caused cancer. Johnson & Johnson faces tens of thousands of claims. Harris's book is called No More Tears. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. F. Scott Fitzgerald's beloved classic, The Great Gatsby, is 100 years old today. The novel has been adapted numerous times, including a new musical that opened on Broadway last year. Now, Gatsby got decent reviews when it was first published in 1925, but it was actually not a commercial success, and that disappointment came at an important time in the life of its author.
He's essentially past his commercial peak already. But he wants to be taken seriously as an artist. This is somebody that really sits down and puts the pedal to the metal and comes up with a book that nobody expected.
That's Kirk Kernut. He's executive director of the Fitzgerald Society, which is an international fan club with over 500 members. The group likes to celebrate Fitzgerald's full repertoire.
We try not to let him get stereotyped as a one-hit wonder, because he was not by any means. But I think Gatsby endures because it really is saying something about America.
Author Claire Anderson Wheeler didn't grow up in the U.S., but she remembers the first time she picked up the book at 14.
I couldn't believe that so much was being said about such a slim little novel.
Years later, The Great Gatsby inspired Anderson Wheeler's new novel titled The Gatsby Gambit. Her novel, which has a slightly more contemporary lens, centers on a female character but sticks with the ideas of the classic.
Some of the questions that I was interested in exploring are very much related to those ideas of money, class, power, really how the 1% operate, and what Fitzgerald would have called the careless people that he identified as the Buchanans.
But what makes the book relevant a century after its publication?
We continue to be gripped, obviously tormented even, by the issues of social inequality. And Fitzgerald's famously attributed quote of "the rich are different."
And so we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. Happy 100th birthday to The Great Gatsby, no longer in its young and more vulnerable years.
The older you get, the harder it is to stay fit. Some even lose the ability to work out. According to the National Institute on Aging, about a third of adults over the age of 70 have trouble walking, getting out of a car, or climbing stairs. This can make simple daily tasks difficult and increase the chance of falls. But one intense workout each week, lasting only 20 minutes, can make a difference. It's called slow strength training, and I wanted to give it a try.
Basically, it's you're moving the weight very slowly, so you're eliminating momentum.
That's Melinda Hughes, owner of the Strength Shop in Los Angeles.
But the muscles, because we've worked them so intensely, they need a much longer recovery period. So the recovery period from this workout is 5 to 7 days.
74-year-old Gilda Haas is one of her clients. Haas and her husband are raising a 10-year-old, and she says she wants to be resilient for the people who depend on her.
Where I hope to be is if I fall down, I won't break my hip. That's my goal. And also that I could keep up with a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old when I'm in my 80s. Yeah, that would be great.
She reclined the leg press machine as her trainer, Arjen von Eimeren, coached.
Here we go again, pushing out. And so what we're doing is we're going for muscle failure.
That means you work your muscle to the point where you cannot move it anymore.
Once that happens, we notice it. That's where the client stops. We still hold the weight there for an extra 10 seconds. That's where, here we go, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
The weight machines here are different from what you'd see in most other gyms. They're often used in medical facilities for osteopathic and muscle rehabilitation. Another client, 87-year-old Fred Fragan, says balance and strength are critical at his age.
One of the reasons that I injured my knee was because I didn't have good balance. I didn't have the strength that I had needed. So this has really helped, dramatically helped.
I was curious what slow lifting until failure could do for me. Von Eimeren set me up in the leg press. I was a little nervous because these days, apart from running up hills, I rarely do any strength training for my legs. But I sat in the machine, put my feet up on the vertical platform in front of me, took a deep breath, and went for it.
Yeah, but you're using momentum there.
No.
Good, so we're gonna slow that down. Maybe this weight is a little challenging for you.
About a minute into lifting 306 pounds, I was regretting my 10-mile run that morning, but I did make it to failure.
That was a lot more difficult than I thought, yeah, to try and just keep and control the weight and do it slowly.
Over on the chest press, I needed a little extra motivation, and this gym doesn't allow music because they really want you to focus on the trainer's instructions.
I'm listening to Metallica in my head. I'm trying to get myself in the mindset. Enter Sandman.
All right, here we go. Pulling the shoulder blades down.
As I was lifting, Hughes began explaining what was happening physiologically.
So those are the muscle fibers, the muscle cells in your muscle that use oxygen to produce ATP, which is muscle energy.
As I didn't hear a word you said.
Okay, that's okay. You're getting close to muscle failure. Pull those shoulder blades down here.
Even though my muscles were at failure, I didn't feel like a failure. I was sweating and spent, but felt good. The Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans recommends that adults get at least 2.5 hours of moderate exercise each week, including strength training at least twice a week. So what about 20 minutes a week?
That makes sense to me, that if you did one day a week at a very high intensity, you would still get strength gains and strength benefits.
Dr. Robert Fielding is a professor of nutrition and medicine at Tufts University and specializes in research on aging.
There are improvements in muscle strength when you do this kind of slow resistance program. Whether those improvements are better or less than they are with a more conventional resistance training program, I just don't think we have enough information to know.
But he says any exercise that's safe and enjoyable is a good exercise. As for me, I like running, and I wouldn't want to wait a whole nother week between workouts. But maybe 20 years from now, that kind of schedule will be exactly what I need.
This is NPR News.
The punk rock band Blink-182 was as popular as ever when they broke up.
It felt like my world had ended. It felt like I had gotten divorced, like someone had died. It felt like a huge sense of loss.
I'm Juana Summers. In his new book, lead singer Mark Hoppus tells the story of how one of the biggest bands in the world overcame all the small things on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The U.S. and Russia say they've carried out another prisoner swap. The exchange marks the second American freed from a Russian prison since President Trump returned to the White House. NPR's Charles Maines has more.
According to the deal, Russia released Ksenia Karelina, a dual Russian and American citizen who'd been serving out a 12-year sentence in a Russian prison colony. A native of Russia's Ural Mountains, who later moved to Los Angeles, the ballet dancer was detained while visiting her parents in Russia in February of last year. The reason, Karelina had donated just over $50 to a Ukrainian aid charity. She was later convicted of financing the Ukrainian army. Under the exchange, Russia's FSB says the U.S. freed Arthur Petrov, a dual Russian-German citizen accused of illegally exporting military-grade electronics in violation of U.S. sanctions on Russia over its actions in Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is set to hold a vote this morning on the Republican budget blueprint passed by the Senate. It was supposed to have happened last night, but Johnson was forced to delay because he didn't have the votes. But now?
I'm happy to tell you that this morning I believe we had the votes.
Holdout conservatives wanted even more cuts than in the Senate version. Wall Street is trading lower at this hour. The Dow is down 935 points, the Nasdaq down 559. The S&P 500 is down 147. You're listening to NPR News. Inflation eased more than expected last month. The Labor Department says the Consumer Price Index, a measure of the cost of goods and services, fell 0.1% to 2.4%, showing prices continue to cool and that the Federal Reserve is making progress on inflation. This amid President Trump's chaotic tariff implementation, which he paused from many for 90 days yesterday. Others remain, though, as he ratcheted up his tariffs against China. Dyeing eggs is a beloved Easter tradition, but as NPR's Chloe Velbin reports, egg prices are still high.
Marshmallows, small potatoes, egg-shaped clumps of dough and clay. These are among the objects professional crafters are gussying up instead of eggs this Easter. Jennifer Needham runs the children's party planning website, The Party Teacher, where she recently wrote about egg dyeing.
I explored this because I just thought, who's going to want to waste eggs on dyeing this year? You still want to have the tradition with your kids, but it's just too expensive.
Retailers like Walmart and Michaels are taking advantage of the trend by selling craft egg kits for as little as a couple of dollars. But not all fake eggs are created equal when it comes to dyeing, Needham says.
I tried dyeing plastic and wood eggs, and the dye slides right off of plastic. But if you have a good quality wood egg with a matte finish, then the dye will stick.
The hitch is wooden eggs are more expensive than real ones. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Many investors are breathing a sigh of relief after President Trump suspended some of his new tariffs for 90 days. The stock market soared following a series of sharp drops, but it's yet to fully recover from the damage done by Trump's trade war. And business people are still trying to figure out what comes next. With me now is NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Lily.
Okay, it's pretty clear that the stock market was not happy with the president's tariffs. How are investors feeling now?
The message from the market could not be any clearer. The market likes global trade and does not like anything that interferes with that. When President Trump was running interference with his steep tariffs, the market sank. When he suspended some of those tariffs, the market soared. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 2,700 points yesterday. The S&P 500 index was up more than 8.5%. But keep in mind, that's only about two-thirds of what the market had lost since the president first announced these tariffs last Wednesday. So even with this partial ceasefire, the trade war has left a mark.
But Scott, not all tariffs are gone, right?
That's right. There's still a 10% tariff on nearly everything the U.S. imports, and that's significantly higher than we were paying a few months ago. But the tariffs Trump has suspended would have been higher still. So let's say you go to the grocery store and you're buying some Italian cheese to put on your pasta tonight. This time yesterday, there was a 20% import tax on that Pecorino Romano. Today, the tariff is half of that. So are you grateful you can grate for less or disappointed that the tariff is still higher than it was before Trump took office? I spoke to Philip Marfuji, who runs the Ambriola Company. That's a big cheese importer in New Jersey. He would rather see no tariffs.
Ideally, I would think it should be 0-0 and have free trade both ways between the U.S. and Europe and let the consumers decide whether they want to buy a domestic product or a European product.
Americans are already unhappy about the cost of groceries. Even a 10% import tax is not going to help with that. Marfuji says some companies may shift to smaller packages to try to mask the cost of these tariffs. And since imported cheese is going to cost more, he suspects domestic dairy producers will raise their cheese prices as well.
Okay, and Trump has not lowered the tax on goods from China. In fact, he's raised it. What impact is that going to have?
When it comes to China, the trade war is still very much in force, and that is a headache for people like Bonnie Ross. She imports clothing from China to sell at discount stores like Burlington and Dee's. Ross notes that over the last week, Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods have gone from 20% to 54% to 104% and now 125%.
And who knows where it's going to go from here? It's just insanity. And this is every industry. It's not just mine. Toys, food, everything. There's nothing unaffected.
Aside from the cost, which is significant, there's also just the uncertainty. Bonnie Ross typically places big clothing orders 5 months out, so there's time to make and move the clothes across the ocean. How do you do business in an environment where you don't know what the tariff's going to be this afternoon, let alone during back-to-school shopping season next September?
I don't think that they really understood the chaos that was going to ensue once they did all this without giving people enough time to plan. He's going to put a lot of people out of business, and people are going to lose their jobs, and I might be one of them.
You know, for the moment at least, investors are relieved by this 90-day pause on at least some of the president's tariffs, but it has been a very rocky 7 days, and the roadmap could change at any moment with another stroke of the president's big Sharpie pen.
NPR's Scott Horsley, I'm sure we'll be talking again soon. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
Later today on All Things Considered, how uncertainty about tariffs is affecting consumers shopping for new cars. Listen on your smartphone, smart speaker, or on your radio. President Trump signed two executive orders targeting individuals from his first administration.
The orders stripped the security clearances of former top cybersecurity official Chris Krebs and former national security official Miles Taylor. They also order investigations into their conduct while they were federal employees. These are just the latest in a pattern that's emerged of Trump bringing down the full weight of the presidency on individuals and private companies.
Here to help us understand what happened and why is NPR political correspondent Ashley Lopez. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning.
Okay, let's start with Chris Krebs. What exactly does this executive order say?
So this order broadly accuses Christopher Krebs, the former head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, also known as CISA, of weaponizing his government authority when running that agency some years ago. Specifically, Trump's order claims that Krebs was misusing his office by censoring conservative viewpoints under the guise of combating misinformation.
So what are some examples of what he says Krebs was censoring?
Yeah, so, well, it's a slew of conservative grievances we've been hearing in the past several years, so Hunter Biden's laptop and the origins of COVID-19. But most notably, this is about the 2020 election. For folks who don't remember this, right after the 2020 election, Krebs, who, by the way, has described himself as a lifelong Republican and he had been appointed by Trump, basically refuted Trump's big lie about the election being stolen. Here he is on NPR in December of that year.
This was a secure election. That is a success story. That is something that everyone in the administration should be proud of.
As you can imagine, Trump didn't like that. He fired Krebs at the time, and now he's ordering the Attorney General, the Director of National Intelligence, and other agency leaders to immediately suspend any active security clearances held by him and entities associated with him.
And what about Miles Taylor?
Yeah, so Miles Taylor is a former Department of Homeland Security official, and in 2018, he wrote this pretty high-profile anonymous op-ed criticizing Trump. He later wrote a book and lifted his anonymity. In yesterday's order, Trump accused Taylor of treasonous behavior, and now Taylor will be the subject of an investigation by the department he once worked for.
So this sounds sort of similar to the executive orders Trump has issued against private law firms.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a theme throughout the first few months of his administration. A lot of what Trump has been focused on is political retribution, whether it's law firms that are not aligned with his interests or university leaders who don't share his worldview. Trump has been directly focused on dealing with all of these perceived enemies.
So what does this tell us about the priorities of the president and his administration?
Well, I mean, if nothing else, it seems like a lot of his priorities right now have a lot to do with his first term. He remembers who had his back at the time and who didn't. It's worth noting that this is an example of the Department of Justice being weaponized against people who criticized Trump in the past, which was a fear that many Democrats vocalized ahead of the election and something that Republicans accused Democrats of doing while in office, specifically around January 6th.
NPR political correspondent Ashley Lopez. Thank you, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you.
This is NPR News.
Remember the viral story of a man swallowed by a whale and then spit out amazingly, all captured on video? Well, the team from Endless Thread talks to him next time, here and now.
NPR is on the radio, online, and at your fingertips, wherever you go. Stay connected. Take the news with you on your smartphone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. It's been more than 50 years since a human has set foot on the moon. Someone may be walking around up there again soon, though. NASA is preparing to go back. But before they do, NASA's trying to solve an important problem. What do they do when an astronaut poops? So they started a competition, the Luna Recycle Challenge. Whoever comes up with the best way to recycle human waste will win $3 million. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The White House says it is freezing more than $1 billion in federal funding for Cornell University and almost $800 million for Northwestern University. It says the money will be held up while alleged civil rights violations are investigated at both schools. The cuts are part of an effort by the Trump administration to use government funding to force colleges and universities to comply with the president's political agenda. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny joins us to tell us more about this. Good morning, Alyssa.
Good morning.
So say more about these latest developments. What's the backstory?
So these private colleges, Cornell University in New York and Northwestern University in Illinois, this large funding pause is stemming from an investigation the Department of Education launched into 60 universities for allegedly failing to protect Jewish students on campus. The administration says the research funds are going to be frozen while it investigates. And I should note that the Department of Education has never fully cut off funding to an institution over civil rights violations until, of course, this year when Trump has done this now at a handful of universities.
How does this affect the ongoing work of these universities, say, doing, you know, research into issues like, you know, cancer, for example? Does the research just stop?
Well, it does. I mean, for example, take Cornell. In a statement, the university said it had received more than 75 stop work orders from the Department of Defense related to research in national defense, cybersecurity, health. Those grants, they said, fund research into things like jet engines, superconductors, space and satellite communications, and cancer research.
Is this legal?
So the government has the power to withhold federal funds from universities, but it's the way they're going about it that caused some legal questions. Here's Michael Dorf. He's a law professor at Cornell.
The answer to the question, can the government do this, is no. The answer to the question, can the government get away with this, is unknown.
So if the government finds that students' civil rights were violated, the law says, like, the next step is to make sure, A, it doesn't happen again going forward, and then B, there are all sorts of procedural hoops, like making a report to Congress, negotiating with the university. All of that has to happen before funding is cut.
So how might a college or university leader respond to this?
Well, really, the only way would be a lawsuit. And it's kind of this existential question for universities. Basically, can I survive financially right now if I put up a legal fight? Because a lawsuit could take a long time. And even then, there's a risk that this whole thing could backfire for them. Okay, maybe they get their current grant money unfrozen, but what about future grants from the federal government? Are those at risk? Here's Dorf.
I fully understand the trepidation of university leadership because they're not only thinking about can we win this case, but can we secure our funding going forward into the future?
Alyssa, I have a different question here, but are there people who see these cuts and agree with them?
Well, there is certainly a sentiment among some scholars that universities are profiting off federal research grants, that the system that was set up after World War II to have the federal government fund research through universities has just ballooned too big. I talked with Richard Vedder, a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, a libertarian think tank, and the author of the forthcoming book, Let Colleges Fail.
It's not perhaps the ideal way to change things. It may be a disruptive way to change things, a chaotic way to change things, in some cases even an unfair way to change things. But nonetheless, a message is being sent.
He argues that higher education has a lot of waste, and he sees the administration's attempt to reevaluate research grant money as a valid one.
That is NPR's Alyssa Nadworny. Alyssa, thank you.
You bet.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Thank you.
How to plan money decisions when the economic universe changes in a blink.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is currently looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who are interested in building a career and joining an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. After President Trump's abrupt U-turn on tariffs yesterday affecting most countries in the world but China, stock prices soared yesterday. The stock market posted its third biggest single-day jump since the Second World War, NASDAQ up 12%. But this morning, the NASDAQ is back down about 3.2%. I see the S&P is down 2.6%. The Dow is down 900 points even, 2.3%. Investors have just been reminded that the economic landscape can be painted over in an instant, with President Trump saying that he acted, quote, instinctively more than anything else. Russ Mould is investment director at the UK-based AJ Bell.
Having to try and manage your money according to policy, which can change very quickly, or a social media post, which can appear even quicker, is very, very difficult. So I think the secret is really, if you possibly can, not get dragged into the moment-to-moment, day-to-day news. If you've taken a little bit more risk than you feel comfortable with, maybe that's what you need to be checking for, because in the end, investing is about patient accumulation overnight. And if it's keeping you awake at night, then you probably have taken more risk than you would, than perhaps you've thought. And maybe that's what you should be checking on.
Crude oil, using the New York price, is under $61 a barrel as we speak, down this morning. That, I think, is in part a bet that some big economies around the world could be headed for an economic downturn amid all this uncertainty about, for instance, world trade. You must see risks of a downturn, Mr. Mould.
I think the longer that we have this policy uncertainty, I think that's a very, very genuine risk. And I must admit, I'm glad I'm talking about this rather than actually running a company. You've got an awful lot of different things to think about. You don't know at the moment from one day to the next whether, you know, America or one of your other potentially biggest trading partners is putting tariffs on or not. And that's going to be a really, really difficult thing for you to navigate. Under those circumstances, therefore, there has to be a risk that executives just sit on their hands, don't make that investment, don't make that hire. And that could still lead to the slowdown that many people were fearing, like, say, Goldman Sachs, before the president decided to impose the 90-day pause on the reciprocal tariffs.
Russ Mould, investment director at the UK-based investment platform AJ Bell, thank you very much.
Okay, no, it's a pleasure to help.
Now, again, the big U.S.-China tariffs remain. U.S. 125%, China 84%. Now to products U.S. farmers tend to sell in China but have trouble selling elsewhere. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
Washington and Beijing are playing a game of chicken, and that includes chicken feet. If U.S. products get too expensive in China, American farmers are worried about losing a key market for things like chicken feet that people in many other countries don't eat, but the Chinese love.
We very well could take a hit.
Davy Stevens raises chickens in Clinton, Kentucky, specifically broilers for Pilgrim's Pride. So he doesn't sell directly to China, but he knows it's the market for chicken feet. He's hoping Chinese consumers love them so much they won't blink at higher prices.
When you go somewhere in the supermarket or go to eat, if there's something you really want and it's a delicacy, you're willing to pay and you've got the money, you're probably going to pay for it. When the emerging middle class I've seen evolve into China, maybe the consumer's willing to pay more.
Pig parts that don't appeal to Western palates are also big in China.
Snouts, feet, ears, organs, those types of products.
That's Joe Sheely, spokesman for the U.S. Meat Export Federation, a trade group. He says U.S. pork will now face a total 131% import tax in China. China imports almost 60% of U.S. pork parts, so it would be a difficult market to replace, although Sheely says they've tried.
We have made an effort to, for example, ramp up our promotion of those types of products in Latin America, Southeast Asia, places like that. Unfortunately, you piece those markets together, they really don't add up to what China is able to take.
Sheely says the cost of animal feed is falling, driven by lower prices for corn and soybean meal, and that could partially cushion the blow if the Chinese market for pork and pig parts took a big hit from tariffs. But farmers don't have a huge profit margin because they're paying higher prices for other things.
You're looking at everything from building materials to insurance to fuel costs.
Add the uncertainty of the tariff war to the mix, and Sheely says it's no wonder that farmers are concerned about losing a key market for products that much of the world doesn't want. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
President Trump said yesterday that market jitters prompted him to bail on tariffs for now. This has relieved some strain in the bond market today, with the 10-year interest rate at 4.33%. That's down. The consumer price index for March is in, down 0.1%, but year over year prices rose 2.4%. That's down from the 2.8% annual rate in February. Gas prices were way down.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, dedicated to helping businesses save time on office tasks and empower leaders with business buying solutions that support teams to focus on growing the business. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at Schwab.com.
Cheaper and faster than a bachelor's degree is a certificate. A report out today from the National Student Clearinghouse finds students earning certificates went up 11% last academic year. Here's Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes.
When Alexander Treya left the Army last spring after 10 years of service, he felt kind of scared.
It's a pretty daunting thing to kind of restart over again at 30, but I knew that I, wanted to work with my hands.
So he enrolled in the HVAC program at the Tennessee College of Applied Technology in Nashville. He expects to graduate in January with multiple certificates, ready to enter the workforce as an HVAC technician. And Doug Shapiro, who leads the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center, says the workforce is ready for him.
There's been growing demand for workers with these types of vocational skills.
Shapiro says the jump in certificates is being driven by employers who want to be certain the workers they're hiring have a specific skill set.
Certificates really put a finer point on that and say, here are the things that this person has actually learned to do.
Shapiro says students are also attracted to certificates' lower cost and shorter time frame compared to higher degrees. Some take just a few months. I'm Stephanie Hughes from Marketplace.
Thank you, Stephanie. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.